This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast series on New Books Network. My name is Hui Ying, and I'm here as one of the hosts on the channel. Today, it is our great pleasure to welcome Amanda Wainwright, Associate Professor at University of South Carolina, with her recent new book, The Golden Key, Modern Women Artists and Gender Negotiations in Republican China, published 2021 with Brill and Leiden. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, thank you.
So to get things started, would you like to share a few words about yourself, your background with our audience at New Books Network?
Sure. Well, I guess first of all, I should say thank you, Huiying, for inviting me to appear in this broadcast and talk about my book. And you know, when I was thinking about speaking with you and maybe anticipating some of the questions you would ask, and maybe questions that listeners might have, and thinking about what I might share about myself, I thought it would be good to start with answering a question that I often probably most frequently get, which is, you know, over the years, people often ask me how I first became interested in Chinese art, Chinese art history. And eventually, after answering this or attempting to answer this question so many times, I realized eventually that this all came out of me earning my bachelor's degree at University of Missouri in Kansas City, which is in, you know, Midtown Kansas City. And at the time, being a poor college student, I appreciated cheap forms of cheap entertainment. And so as an art history major, that meant frequenting the local art museum, probably about weekly. So I frequented the art museum. And in Kansas City, luckily for me, the art museum is Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, which has a world-class collection of Chinese art. That's thanks to Lawrence Sickman. And his collecting efforts really in the period, the same period that is the topic of my book, right? 1930s and 40s. And so, you know, whether I realized it at the time or not, I spent years absorbing and learning to appreciate the contents of the permanent collection of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. And then later, when I went to the University of Oregon for my master's degree, I never planned to return to the Kansas City area. When it came time to select a PhD program, KU, University of Kansas, was really the only one that stood out to me, that appealed to me. And at the time, I thought I was interested in Chinese Buddhist sculpture, but I later became enthralled with the art of early 20th century China. And again, this was probably a happy accident, because KU is where Zhu Xing Li taught for decades, and he was one of the first scholars in the U.S. to appreciate, collect, and teach modern Chinese art. So by the time I arrived at KU, you know, I arrived in Lawrence, Kansas. He had long since retired. I think I only ever met him once. but his tenure at KU profoundly shaped Spencer Museum of Art's collection, and it gave me a wonderful, wonderful research opportunities. And so that really led me to where I am today.
Thank you for sharing. I think it's really interesting to hear your almost serendipitous encounter with this art collection. And I would just follow on what you just said and ask, so how did you decide, or how did you come to write this particular book focusing on modern women artists in early 20th century China?
So I guess I would say the short answer to that question is that it stemmed from my dissertation, probably not surprising for a first book, right? My dissertation focused on Choti, who later became the subject of chapter 2 of this book. I suppose a longer answer is that when I chose chose my dissertation topic, I felt the implicit support of my advisor, Marcia Hoffler, who decades earlier, under the name Marcia Widener, had been responsible for two trailblazing works on women artists in pre-modern East Asia. One was an exhibition catalog, Views from Jade Terrace, that focused on Chinese women artists on 1300 to 1912. The other's Flowering in the Shadows, which is an edited volume on Chinese Japanese women painters. And so as I was exploring potential dissertation topics, what I discovered is that the tremendous changes of the Republican period in its art fascinated me. And of all the artists that I encountered in my research, those of Jiulensha or the Storm Society appealed to me most, because they seemed, collectively, they seemed so determined to fight the status quo. And of all the members in the group, who could be seen fighting the status quo more than its only officially recognized female member, Choti, right? So I think as I started narrowing in on my dissertation topic, Marcia recognized a kind of kindred determination in my research to bring to light an artist who had previously remained relatively obscure, primarily as a consequence of her gender, right? And so she never dissuaded me from the topic, even though Choti's own daughter, Peng Tao, actually told me, you know, I interviewed her and she told me that she was concerned that I would really struggle with this. She was really glad that I was taking this, taking her mother up as a dissertation topic, but she was worried I'd struggle to find enough material to support a dissertation. So spoiler is, I did find enough material. I did complete a dissertation on Choti, but the main feedback I had that I received on that dissertation was that the committee really wanted to know more, even more about Choti's peers, her female peers, and how Choti's experiences were similar to or different from those of other women artists of her era. And so when I turned to writing my book, I decided to broaden its scope, and I discovered that the trajectory of Choti's career was largely mirrored by other women artists of her era. And this, of course, is because they were operating in a powerful social context that was fixated on concepts of modern womanhood, or what it meant to be a woman in early 20th century, not just in China, but globally. And so much of the rhetoric espoused in contemporary discourse draws on a global dialogue of so-called new women who were to be educated and independent, and who could actively contribute toward the betterment of society, as well as, in theory, determine their own fates. But in early 20th century China, the new woman bore even more responsibility, not just for herself, but for the very nation, right? For all of China, as her successes promised to either, they promised to overthrow outdated Confucian morals and traditions, and thereby help the struggling nation, the Republican nation, rally and modernize. So in my book, I greatly enjoyed exploring these larger issues and then saw how they bore down on, really in some cases with crushing weight on the lives of individual women artists.
Thank you, Amanda, for sharing kind of your journey in finding the key or the golden key to this untold world of modern women artists. I think from now on, we will be moving on to the main gist of the book, and we will be revealing a little bit what is the golden key, what does golden key mean here, and also the main thread, as you just mentioned, what does new woman or modern woman mean to early 20th century China? So to start, I was wondering, how did Republican media or media in early 20th century China portray the woman artist, for example, Guan Zilan, in the contemporary periodicals, and how this particular woman artist used her public persona as the modern lady to invent and define her new occupational role through performance?
Right. I guess, you know, I just want to take a moment and mention, because I think, you know, that it might not be obvious with the title, how it ties into the content of the book. But, so much of this discourse on women artists and their roles in modern society took place in the periodicals of the day, particularly in Shanghai. And so one woman educator, Jin Qijing, she actually, in one of her essays, she talks about how arts, the arts, visual arts, are the key, the golden key that can lead to women's liberation, right? And women's participation in the society. So that's what I draw on then for the title. And then I talk about how, particularly in the first couple chapters, about how the lives and careers of these individual women artists intertwine, right, with that narrative, right, that discourse. So looking at Guan Zilan, right, viewing the media coverage of Guan Zilan from the distance of here, it's almost 100 years later, right? And this was fascinating to me, at least. And so obviously, in some ways, looking at the media coverage of her from the late 1920s, early 1930s, it was very revealing of the rise and fall of trends and conventions, right? But on the other hand, what was more surprising to me, again, at least, was how this media coverage really tended to epitomize the saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? So so here, Guan Zilan, here was a woman who, for at least a period of her life, had a very close relationship with the media, which documented all aspects of her life, from her career and her artworks to her fashion and her social circles. And you might say the same about any number of female celebrities today, right? That there's tremendous media scrutiny of their, not just their careers, but also their lives and all aspects of their lives. And so the medium has changed. You know, in Guan Zilan's day, she appeared in magazines and newspapers, while today we use social media and websites, but the phenomenon is the same, right? And Guan Zilan, in her lifetime, in the 20s and 30s, she was right in the middle of a huge phenomenon of her day, which was centered on the celebrity modern artist. And in particular, the celebrity of the modern woman artist, who was typically identified as a nuhua jia, or a woman painter, as a distinct cultural professional, as an identity or an occupational role. And of course, you know, there's major social historical developments driving this interest in artists, both male and female. But for new Huajia, especially, their prevalence in contemporary discourse is intertwined with a focus on social reform, right, which I was alluding to earlier. And so, you know, this idea of the new woman and the so-called liberation of women. A vexing question, right, with the media coverage of Guan Zilan and really of all the women artists is how much agency did the women themselves have in this broader discussion, right? And so in my book, I argue that Guan Zilan manipulated the media herself as much as it may have attempted to manipulate her. And she was able to quite cunningly use the media to her own advantage. And we see this in, you know, I provide examples, and we see it in coverage such as the embedded reporter who followed her and documented her trip to Japan in almost real time, thanks to modern technology. I hope that answers your question about Zilan.
Guan Zilan, this female artist, is one of the leading characters for the first chapter, A Beacon in the Distance. And as Amanda just shared more, the chapter goes beyond the Guan Zilan's life story or what her deeds or her achievement, but kind of discusses the social movement or social happenings at the time. So here, what we were trying to do is to introduce a little bit to our audience and hope you could find it more intriguing or more oriented when you start to read the book yourself. So for the next chapter, the second one that begs to Qiu Ti, the protagonist you already mentioned of your dissertation. So here in chapter two, how was Qiu Ti's career shaped by the dynamics of the storm society she participated in and gender politics at the time?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, it's complicated, right? An answer to that question is quite complicated. So on the one hand, Qiu Ti received acclaim as the Storm Society's only female member. And the publicity that she received tended to focus on her gender in her, as well as her relationship with her husband, fellow group member, Peng Xunqin. So it could be argued that she owed her very success to gender, right, to her gender, and that possibly there was more interest in her identity as a new Huajia or female artist than in her actual artwork, right? On the other hand, right, during her career, Qiu Ti tended to be pigeonholed and typecast. And, you know, most notably in my, as I argue in my book, this occurred really in the writings of the Storm Society's spokesman, Ni Yida. So her identity as a woman artist was distorted to some extent to build claims about the progressiveness of the avant-garde art group that inducted her, right? Which at the same time crowed about its exclusivity by proclaiming or publicly proclaiming her, Qiu Ti, to be its only female member, when in fact she most likely was not. She was not their only female member. Probably, as I again talk about in this chapter, probably Liang Baibo was a founding member of the Storm Society, but that disagreed with the narrative that Ni Yida was, that he sought to construct. So it was conveniently forgotten, right? But if we return to Qiu Ti, you can imagine that her early artistic career was largely marginalized and controlled by the group's interests. And what this meant is that her name and image was trotted out strategically for publicity. But in Nida's articles, he clearly prioritized other as male group members. That said, even if she was in some ways treated as a token female member of the group, at least she had gained entry, right? And what happens is later, you know, like at least that gave her a platform, that being a member of that group, even though it was to some extent controlling, you know, her image, she did have a platform and a public profile. And so later, after the group disbanded, she struggled to even continue her career. And her husband, meanwhile, was able to maintain his career as the breadwinner of the family. But unfortunately, because of wartime, wartime forced her into the role of a stay-at-home mom. And then after the war, just the very, very concept of avant-garde artist was just, you know, avant-garde artist was no longer a viable career option, really, for anyone.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Thank you. I think here, as you briefly recounted, chapter two talks about Chiyoti as well as others, how they negotiated or interacted with one of the social discourse at the time, particularly gender politics. And I think that in chapter two, you're venturing into another kind of modernist discourse or social discourse, focusing on the women artist Pan Yuliang. So how did Pan Yuliang's engagement in the modernist discourse surrounding this newly popular genre of the female nude painting challenge conventional gender theory and modern art theory?
Right. Yeah, so this is a very interesting question. Thank you. Yeah. So in chapter three, I look at Pan Yuliang, and almost in many cases, I'm attempting to use these women sort of as case studies of larger trends or topics or themes. With first chapter, Guanzalan, I'm looking at women's relationship in larger society and in the media, and these ideas of modern womanhood, the new woman, and so on, the idea of a new huajia. The chapter two, I'm looking at Chiyoti and group dynamics, right? Gender politics, right? As you point out. And so here in chapter three, I'm looking at the genre of the nude, right? Which was hugely popular. And perhaps I think for some people today, surprisingly popular in modern China. So if we're talking, so I think that there's multiple ways we could kind of take apart some of this question. In terms of Pan Yuliang's own participation in the production of images of nudes, particularly female nudes, I would say that she fit right in. Right, she fit right into the prevailing modernist discourse. And at the time, then conventional gender theory and modern art theory, at least that held by the reformers, those who wanted to reform Chinese society and the modern era, the conventional theory was that women could and should pursue education and careers. And of course, this belief extended to the visual arts as well. So women were accepted into co-educational art programs, including life drawing classes. And Pan Yuliang even became an educator in some of these programs. So I wouldn't say that she challenged convention so much as upheld newly formed conventions, right? But in writing about Pan Yuliang and her art practice, what's really challenged are today's prevailing notions about art and gender. right? That is widely held assumptions today are widely held assumptions that the nude was rare and controversial as a subject in early 20th century China, or that women weren't active players in China's early 20th century art world, right? And what I aim to document in my book is that not only were women actively contributing to the development of the art world, but they also engaged in the dominant trends and practices of the day, including painting the female nude, which was held up by art theorists such as Ni Yida, who you really can't escape at this time. He's so influential and so prominently published, right? But he and other art theorists are holding up the nude, the female nude in particular, as essential to the modernist cause. So scores of women artists were painting and sculpting nudes and exhibiting and publishing their images in high profile venues.
Thank you. I think Pan Yuliang is indeed very representative, as you were saying, for this avant-garde women artist participating not just in new forms of expressing themselves, but new genre, new content, new subjects of painting, and supposedly reach to a wider audience for different kind of coming to this subject for different kind of purposes. And for the next chapter, I think it gets more solemn, the topic, as we kind of passed the prime day or heyday of avant-garde or female avant-garde artists, and we're moving on to this intense time during the 1930s where political campaigns and wartime hardships are not only putting causing problems to other parts of the society, but definitely impacting the occupational choices or other life trajectories of these artists, particularly female artists. And here we read about three modern artists' stories, including that of Liang Baibo. You mentioned that connecting to Ying Qiuti's story, but I would like to point out this Liang Baibo is the author of the front cover cartoon or illustration of this book, which is very provocative. I hope I could show you via the podcast, but it's something that you just want to open the book and find out more what indeed the cartoon means. So here, Amanda, I want to ask, what do you think is the most extraordinary aspect in these women artists' participation and struggle during this time in a war as a women artist?
So this is a very difficult, this is a very hard question. And I think that that's because this chapter takes on so much, really, admittedly. For instance, this one chapter discusses three women artists, whereas in each of the other chapters, I focus on just one woman artist, right? So already it's dealing with quite a bit more than the other chapters, but also because the women that I discuss in this chapter found themselves on opposing sides, right? The aim of this chapter is to show, however, the uniformity of that adversity that they encountered, no matter which end of the political spectrum they associated with. So that's what I'm hoping ties the chapter together, ties the three of them, my discussion of the three of them together. So for example, Fang Junbi was closely aligned with Wang Jingwei's puppet government in Shanghai. And I guess just to explain, this was a government that was largely propped up by the invading Japanese forces, right? And so Fang Jinbi, she was close friends with Fang Jingwei, and her artwork was, as I talk about in that chapter, was exhibited in support of the Wang Jingwei regime. But this was also then an arena where women's autonomy was sidelined in favor of more conservative values, values of modest behavior and attention to homemaking rather than their careers. While Yufeng and Liang Baibo produced anti-Japanese propaganda for the resistance, right, fighting against that Japanese invasion. And they were operating in a space with few career opportunities for women and really where women were typically portrayed, if at all, they were portrayed as almost entirely as defenseless victims, right? So what we find then, and looking at these three women really operating on two or opposing opposite sides of the political spectrum, is that in both cases, political rhetoric narrowed the acceptable portrayals of womanhood for the purpose of propagandistic imagery. And it also shut down many women's professional careers in the arts. This was with the intent of fitting them into the military apparatus, right, into the war effort, whether as good wives and wise mothers, raising the next generation of fighters that we see more on, Fang Jinbi grappling with, or as maybe nurses and fighters themselves in the fight against the invasion, right, which we really see on the other side of the resistance. So I suppose... this is what is extraordinary, right? That the fact that the opposition that women artists faced in the late 1930s in China was so pervasive, right? But despite this, a few of these women were able to maintain careers, right? Despite all the adversity they encountered.
Yeah, I really like this book, this particular chapter, as it seems to go beyond art history theories or particular like one discourse, but talks about women's livelihood as it happened an artist and living in 1930s, be it Shanghai, Chongqing, or elsewhere, and how she struggles or juggles different kind of perspectives, choices, all kinds of choices, and not much trying to shine, but during this time, trying to survive.
Right, more or less, right. Yes, if you're finding strategies as a woman artist to continue your professional interests, right? Just keeping your career viable.
So, I was wondering, in addition to all this captivating stories and extremely fascinating illustrations you included, is there anything that you had not included in the book that you wished you could?
Oh, yes. I mean, tons, right? Yes. So first of all, there are many, many women artists, right? Many women artists who are not included in the book simply because they would be difficult to discuss in any detail or at length, because even less has been recorded of their careers, right? So there's simply too much of a challenge to work into this book, but also the art itself. So I appreciate that you enjoyed the images. And from my perspective, right, as an art historian, you want to see a book filled with images. And a sort of a concern is that I wish there could have been more, right? That it would have been wonderful if I could have had double or triple the number of illustrations. But in so many cases, the images that I'm discussing simply no longer exist, right? Or they only exist in these tiny little grainy black and white reproductions from the periodicals of the day, right? So, you know, as you can imagine, it's very difficult to explore and even assess an artwork when that's all you have to work with, right? These tiny little poor quality reproductions from magazines. And, you know, really in general, like so little of the artwork from this period in Chinese history has survived, right? Remains extant. And that's true for most artists, including men, right, of this period. But it makes it particularly challenging to resuscitate the forgotten careers of these women artists when there's so little extant evidence of their careers, right? Now, so related to both these points, that I would have loved to include more women artists in general in the book, as well as more examples of their artworks, is related to this is an archive that was sent to me by Ellen Johnston Lang a number of years ago, probably almost a decade ago. And it consists of a collection they're all mentions of women artists that occurred in the Tianjin newspaper, Beiyang Huabao. And she mailed to me then this collection of photocopies and then these note cards documenting, you know, all the bibliographic data, you know, from these. And so it's really, you know, looking through it, then it's really an impressive enterprise that she undertook. This was when she was putting together this archive, it was way back before digital scans, right? Much less online databases. So she went and found, you know, a collection of these Beiyang Huabao newspapers, and she went through every issue and photocopied and notated each relevant page by hand. And we're talking about photocopies of old newspapers, right? So with snippets of information about many women who we know very little or almost nothing else about, other than just what this little remnant that appeared in a newspaper. Not to mention, most of these women artists featured in Beiyang Huabao or the Tianjin newspaper were outside of the modernist camp, right, in the art world at the time. So I never found a way to incorporate them into incorporate that archive into my book. So that's one thing that I wish I could have included, but I wasn't able to. So actually, now that the book is completed, that's one thing that I am working on, is I'm currently working on a website that hopes to breathe new life into Dr. Lang's wonderful and painstaking archive, as well as then incorporate the own resources that I came across in, and some of which were not included in the book either, in the process of researching my book.
That is so wonderful. I think it makes everyone who has read the book or not, but interested in a topic, to have a some database to go whether it's about modern artists in China or women artists in early 20th century China, as I if I understand correctly. That will be extremely useful for graduate students or other researchers. Getting to know the topic or finding specific information that you are working on. Really look forward to the website. Please keep posted.
Thank you. Yes, I hope to, I'm hoping around the end of this year or very early next year to be able to publish the website, at least an initial version of the website online. So please do be looking for it. The name will be New Hua Jia in the news.
Okay, hope we will be able to put the web link on the podcast introduction if it becomes available.
I'll make sure to send it to you.
Yes. Okay, so after we spent quite 40 minutes talking about the Golden Key and this fascinating stories negotiating their paths as a woman artist and living through early 20th century, this turmoil period, early 20th century China. So what are you working on now, or what is your next project, Amanda?
Right. Well, so you mentioned that there's sort of a general trajectory, right? That all these women's careers take, and a sort of arc. There's the height right around the mid 1930s, and then they lose ground, and in most cases lose their careers entirely with the start of the Second Sino-Japanese War, and that's that sort of heartbreaking chapter four, right? When I talk about those three women, Fang Junbi, Liang Baibo, and Yu Fang. And so that's where I really leave them, and I end the book is with that chapter, and just that already, I felt like there was so much more to be said within that chapter, and not just about women artists. It's really a fascinating period with art in general that I think up to this point, relatively little has been published about. So that's going to be the subject of my next book. That's what I'm working on now, is the art of wartime China, primarily focused on that period of the Second Sino-Japanese War, 1937, 1945, but also going a bit further, seeing, as I write the book, seeing how much I want to go into the Civil War that immediately followed. And not just looking at women artists, but also not ignoring them, right? But really looking at the art field as a whole. And so also, this first book really focused mainly on modernist art, but broadening. So even though the period I'm talking about really is going to narrow down, overall the scope in terms of artists will broaden. I've been working on an initial article manuscript on the cartoonists, the National Salvation Cartoonists Association, in that, right around 1938, and their interactions with the media, media publicity, and representing themselves really as fighters, right? Even though maybe they're not physically fighting, but they're using their art as weapons in the war against Japan. And then, having, again, taking thematic looks, kind of like with my first book, but with each chapter sort of focusing on a particular theme, and, having overall having a broader view of the art of that period.
I think it's not just a fascinating, but important topic that you're researching. Like, it's not just art about war, but these artists living through wartime and making art, whether to exhibit or express certain perspectives toward war, or even not relating to the war directly, but definitely influenced by the ongoing war.
Right. No, it's true. And in some cases, we're talking about survival strategies on the part of the artist. And other times, it was viewed by some artists as, an incredible opportunity to really transform the arts in China. And it really ended up being a transformative period. There's much to talk about. I'm very excited about this, this new project, but lots of research and writing left to do.
Me too. I was excited. I think it will be a wonderful book, not just about the art, but also about the wartime period, and also about the life stories of these artists, but also the stories about the artwork and the social history of China at the time, or global history, all together, all combined. Please keep everyone posted about your new project.
I will do so. Yes, and please watch for that website. I'll try to share the link with you
soon. Definitely. Okay. Time indeed flies. And thank you, Amanda, again, for sharing with us your thoughts and more kind of revealer spoiler for the book, The Golden Key, Modern Women Artists and Gender Negotiations in Republican China, published in 2021 with Braille. This is all for today, and I look forward to our next episode. Bye-bye.
Thank you.